Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. Today we're going to be talking about cover crops with special guest Sarah Carlson from Practical Farmers of Iowa. And some other things, too. There's garlic up, garlic to harvest, apricots, and we have our weekly nice
cold dessert of the week.
My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
And you're listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Here we are. Well, the first thing to say about the middle of Iowa and the middle of summer is, my goodness, it has been warm this week.
Finally.
And, my goodness, there have been lots of mosquitoes after a lovely spring and a lovely early summer. We're out there working in our gardens or even going from car to building, and there they are, mosquitoes.
I haven't seen this many mosquitoes since I was in a swamp in the South.
Oh.
It's outrageous.
There you have it. There you have it. Well, what's going on at farmers markets, Donna? What have you been eating?
Well, the beans have been coming in very nicely, both the green beans and the wax beans. And I made a very nice sort of beany potato salad this week with, I used the kind of white sweet potatoes, but they weren't dominant. I actually put lots and lots of two colors of beans and some very finely shaved fennel and some very finely shaved sweet onions. And then I chopped in basil and lovage right out of the garden. And then I think I used a champagne vinegar and olive oil and salt and pepper. And it was delicious.
This is the time for bean salads. And they're available right off the vine in your garden. Or you'll find all kinds of friendly faces at your farmer's market that I'm sure will be glad to sell you beans.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. What else do you find at the farmer's market?
Oh, cucumbers. Of course, still plenty of cabbage. Corn, of course. Lots of corn.
Yeah.
Having lots of corn. Actually, the bean salad would have been good with corn added to it for color. We're still waiting for the tomatoes.
Yeah, this has been a challenging year for tomatoes. There's a lot
but the melons have been coming in good.
Yeah. Good.
Melons.
So, enjoy good food at your farmer's market.
Okay, so let's introduce Sarah Carlson, who is the Practical Farmers of Iowa Midwest Cover Crop Research Coordinator. It's very specific. Sarah is actually a product of the ISU Sustainable Ag Program, so we kind of consider her our local gal. But Sarah has been doing terrific work for, I don't know, what's it, 5 or 6 years since
seven.
She graduated? 7 years? Oh, my goodness. So we're going to talk about cover crops. We're going to get a little horticulture things going in here. The first thing I want to say is Sarah, she's not wearing it today, but she has a fantastic T-shirt that she's been known to wear at places like the State Fair and stuff like that. It says, "Don't farm naked." Sarah, you want to tell us about what that means? Don't farm naked.
Sure. So, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago, we wanted to create a campaign or an idea around covering up our soil. And so kind of a way to think about it funny is to say, well, we shouldn't farm naked. We shouldn't leave our soil naked all winter long, just like you wouldn't send your kids outside in the winter without a coat on or naked. We want to make sure that the soil is not uncovered during the winter. So
you want to give us a little quick 101 basic of what a cover crop is and why it's important and why it's not good to leave the soil naked?
Yeah, and maybe I'll start with why we see the soil naked right now. So, you know, from November on until basically the first week of June, you'll notice Iowa's landscape and throughout the Midwest is uncovered. It's dark. Sometimes there's maybe some corn straw left over on the ground or soybean straw a little bit.
I've heard this landscape compared to slash and burn.
Right. So normally, the soil's uncovered because after harvest, we don't traditionally plant a cover crop. And a cover crop would be a plant that we would either plant sometime in September into the standing corn and soybeans, or we might plant it after harvest, which would be sometime around November 1st. And then that plant grows a little bit in the fall, maybe gets 2 inches tall, And then usually it overwinters. And then in the spring, it really grows, and it's there to protect the soil until you kill it and then plant corn or soybeans again. And so corn and soybeans are two plants that are both called warm season plants. So they grow during the warm season, like green beans or tomatoes.
Like now.
Anything now. So anything that germinates at about 56 degrees soil temperature and then is harvested sometime September through November. But there are winter crops that we used to grow, which are things like wheat and oats, that we grow in other places of the United States now instead of in Iowa. But we used to grow those things. So those might be things in our garden like spinach. Those would be cool season plants. Mm-hmm. So cover crops are cool season plants to fill that winter gap. And we need them on the landscape to cover up the soil so that we can have reduced soil erosion and reduced nitrogen loss and reduced phosphorus loss
and
from our soils.
These things are really important for our beautiful, rich Iowa soil. We need to take better care of it.
It's a good thing to remember that everything we eat goes back to the soil, and taking good care of ourselves, taking good care of what we grow, goes back to taking good care of the soil.
Right, and sometimes we think that if we have waterways or things around the edges of our soil, we're doing a good job. And we're doing a decent job by covering the edges. Like in our garden, we might have raised beds, but then in our walkways, we don't have anything covering our walkways. So the inside of the ground, in between the edges, that needs to be covered also, because that's actually where we grow the crops. So we can't just cover the edges and do a good job on the edges, like with waterways or buffers or terraces or wetlands. We can't just do
the
edges.
So that's a beginning step, but not enough.
Yes, because we actually don't grow crops in wetlands, and we don't grow crops in waterways. We grow the plants in the middle of the field and in the middle of our beds in our garden. So whenever we harvest lettuce, we need to think about what's going to come after that lettuce to cover up that soil, because at any time of the year, we could have erosion. And erosion cuts into yield.
And every time you grow a crop, each crop is different, but crops take up nitrogen, or they take up nutrients. They take things out. There are crops that put things back in, but it's a continuing process of give and take and give and take. So we have to renew the soil, adding fertilizers, adding compost, adding manures. That's one way to do it. But it's really handy to realize that cover crops can do an awful lot of the work for us.
So the efforts that you put into a cover crop basically means you use less fertilizers or inputs that can be expensive, right?
Over time, you could start to use less inputs, yes, because you'd be protecting the basic soil biology. You know, the soil livestock is what gives you the things Lana just described.
Soil livestock? You want to?
Soil livestock like microbes, fungi, earthworms. All those things need food. And if we don't feed them and they're a bare soil and there's a bunch of sun on that soil, their home gets really hot and they can get kind of crispy and die.
So by putting in cover crops, the roots in the ground build more soil microbial families and increase the nutrient density of the, as opposed to just putting on like NKP, which is what's NKP?
Nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, NPK.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like eating your vegetables instead of just taking a vitamin.
Right. Yes.
Because you get more nutrients. More complex nutrients, right?
Yes, yes. So soil microbes really are the things that give us, well, they help with nutrition.
Plus the roots do all kinds of things like aerate the soil and reduce compaction.
Right, exactly, yes. And so sometimes if you pull out a plant's roots and you see soil stuck to its roots, then that means that it is a really good balance with the soil. So it has a really good way to improve the soil microbe population by having that soil that's kind of stuck to the roots. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good sign. And we need those roots because that's what feeds those microbes. And that keeps
them
living.
So you want to leave those roots in the soil?
It'd be ideal. Yes. Yes. So we do notice that, you know, some farmers like to do a lot of tillage, and that could be conventional and organic farmers. And there's always places to reduce tillage because tillage really disrupts the soil microbes' homes. It disrupts fungi's homes. They get cut in half. And it takes them a certain amount of time to regrow. Now, some incorporation of green material is not bad, you know, once in a while. But we probably need to take a good look at tillage and just see where we can reduce it and let the roots do the tillage for us where possible.
So this is like no-till planting, it's called,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, or using roots to biotill. Like a
roots to biotill.
Yeah, like a long daikon radish that mm-hmm. you'd put in your garden that you mm-hmm. might harvest and then make, you know, like a radish salad. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever had this. Yes.
Yes, of course. Of course. We love daikon.
Yes. So a daikon radish is a ginormous tuber that'll burrow down into the soil and create a lot of basically free tillage for you.
So when you're using that for a cover crop, then you just cut the top off and leave the whole thing in the soil, or what do you do?
You don't do anything. So last year, when a lot of farmers got flooded out on the corn and soybean fields, they, you know, sometime in August 1st through 20th or so, they planted radishes, the tillage radish, the daikon radish, is what it's horticulturally referred to as. Mm-hmm. And then they just left it. And that winter killed. And then there were huge holes, you know, around November, December. And then over time, the microbes just digested it, had a big party eating that daikon, and then, you know, filled that hole back in with great soil. And there's huge reduction in compaction.
So you put that in, you just forget about it. Then in the spring when you go in to plant,
you just plant right over it. And there's nothing even there. There's not even really carcasses. It's all broken down.
Carcasses. Vegetable carcasses.
Vegetable carcasses. Yes. Mm.
And this is done on a large scale? Corn and soybean farmers, big acreages of this stuff?
Yes.
Or it's in smaller, like, orchards or smaller market gardens?
So the daikon radish can fit in multiple scenarios. For corn and soybean farmers that are harvesting in the October to November time period, it doesn't fit very well. But if they have a prevent plant where they couldn't get in and plant situation and they have a field open in August, that's a perfect spot. If they're harvesting sweet corn, if they have seed corn, like they're growing for maybe Monsanto or DuPont, that would be an earlier harvest potentially. So any place where they would be harvesting early corn silage, sometime around latest maybe September 10th, mm-hmm. they could drill the radish. Horticulture farms might use it for either harvest or for just cover crop, where they'd leave it alone. Mm-hmm. But its best planting period is in the month of August, kind of August 15th till about September 5th.
So what are other options besides daikon radish?
Yeah, so, you know, when you have an early harvest, meaning a small grain or silage or something that's coming off by September 1st, there are a lot of options. You could plant, you know, really crazy mixes, like what Lana and I were just talking about. She planted buckwheat.
Oh, we.
Or what's your mix?
Yes. We have a wonderful crazy mix in our, and it came up lovely, just lovely this year. Rye, buckwheat, oats, millet, and field peas. And it's a lovely mix.
Yeah, so when you have an early planting date, and I just learned of some farmers in central Illinois that had harvested wheat, and they just put in a 20-species mix, so 20 different mm-hmm. plants. Flax could be in that. I mean, you can get really crazy. Mm-hmm. So,
and are you growing this to harvest, or are you just growing it
just to
for
leave it.
Sport?
Just to feed the soil livestock. For food. It's for food for the soil.
Right.
Oh,
okay. And it's the plants working. It's like bees working for you.
Exactly.
Let the bees. If we had to make honey by ourselves, I think it'd be a lot of work. And if we had to build the soil by ourselves. And it's funny. We think we can do that by adding things. It's really good to have something growing. They know what the plants know what they're doing. I'm really, really fond of buckwheat as a thing to put into a problem area of your garden. Buckwheat is a late season. It likes warm season growing.
So when do you put it in your garden, Lana?
When I take something out,
like
early greens, early peas. I have a area of my garden that I pretty much gave up to crabgrass. And I thought, well, let's fight fire with fire. I knew that buckwheat was pretty much, if you plant it thick enough, it pretty much crowds out anything else. So
you mean I could, like, plant my whole lawn in buckwheat and not have Creeping Charlie?
That might work. But except your lawn is shady. Your lawn is shady and it does need a lot of sunshine. But I've got this one, it's my little own test plot out there, and the buckwheat is winning, I must say. The buckwheat is winning. You said, Sarah, you said something about managing buckwheat, though. You should cut it down. So it's setting flower now, and I can see the little black buckwheat seeds happening. So unless I want it to reseed, which it will do with alacrity, I should cut it down now?
Yeah, you probably should have cut it a week ago.
Oh, there you go. Well, it probably has to fight that crabgrass ed in my garden. I wouldn't mind if it fought it for another season, actually. So there it is. But yeah, all right.
Well, maybe we can harvest it. I mean, I know Earl Hafner started growing buckwheat several years ago, and he was delighted when I started saying, oh, there's a lot of culinary uses for it. He came with me a big bag once, and he said, Donna, I don't know what to do with this. I had it cleaned for a project my granddaughter wanted to use, and then she didn't want it, and what should we do with it? And I was delighted because I'm a huge buckwheat fan. So one of the things we did was to put bags of buckwheat for the silent auction at the PFI event, and it made a lot of money for PFI. People like buckwheat.
Yeah.
Tell us who Earl Hafner is.
Earl Hafner is an organic farmer and in Panora, Iowa, who has now started his own grain milling called Early Morning Harvest. And I must say, Earl is one of these guys. He's got a frog in every pocket. Sarah, tell us about the edible possibilities for some of these grains. Mm.
Sure. So,
I mean, we used to eat this stuff.
Right. So when these plants are cover crops, they would be terminated before we would kill them before we would actually harvest them for grain.
Mm-hmm.
But there are folks that are looking to sell some of their seed to other farmers as cover crops.
And so they can actually – there is a small market for
– yeah, and they're actually the market potential is actually very large because there's a bottleneck of getting seed from Canada into the state in time for planting because Canada's harvest is now.
Oh, so we're having a shortage of cover crop seeds.
Yes, yes. So there are quite a few – farmers growing cereal rye for harvest, and they're right now selling it as cover crop seed, but that could be for food also. So rye, you know, is you can make whiskey out of rye. Actually, we've done this.
We've made whiskey out of Iowa rye. At the, what's it called, the Mississippi Distilling Company has a rye whiskey.
Yes, and they used, for one batch, they used Iowa, PFI Farmers Iowa rye.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rye bread. There's other food uses for rye, but you know, the other small grains like wheat or triticale or barley or oats.
Or buckwheat.
Or buckwheat, yes. Those would be
they're all edible, and we haven't really grown and processed a lot of those in Iowa for a good number of years. And we've lost our abilities to have fanning mills, to clean them. Like buckwheat is not too bad because you can actually grind it right down, just like corn. But wheat, you have to clean it. You have to get rid of the, what is it, that fanning mill? Is that where it separates the chaff from the wheat?
Mm-hmm.
A very biblical phrase there. So we have lost some of those things, and various people are kind of looking at ways to reintroduce these things as food crops in the state, and Earl Hafner being one of them.
Yeah, and so right now it's on a pretty small scale, I'd say. But there is potential. So when we see bottlenecks of even just cover crop seed, that's a market potential.
Good.
You know, we should look to grow more of these crops in Iowa.
So that means not only are we improving our soil and doing the right thing, but there is a potential to reward the farmer from the market.
Yeah, make money.
Important. Yeah. Very important.
Because when we grow these crops that were cover crops that become grain crops, we can grow nitrogen with them. We can grow other plants with them that give us nitrogen at a very reduced cost compared to fertilizer nitrogen.
Plus, we're reducing soil erosion. Big deal.
Yes. But I mean, even in the short term, like the next year, mm-hmm. we can reduce nitrogen fertilizer because maybe we grew red clover with the wheat.
Oh, it would be planted at the same time?
So you would plant winter wheat the fall before, like sometime October.
Uh-huh. After the corn?
after corn or soybeans.
Okay.
You might fly it on. Let's say you're going to – let's say
fly
this,
it on. Sarah, what does fly it on mean?
So let's say you want to do a cover crop. You grow corn and soybeans, and you want to start doing cover crops, and you choose winter wheat. And so you hire a plane that might normally spray fungicides or insecticides on your crops. You hire them to put on a dry box instead of a wet box.
Dry box. Mm-hmm.
To put the seed into.
Mm-hmm.
And then that plane, sometime around Labor Day, will fly seed over your standing crops.
Ha! Huh.
So into the standing crop to get it started. And certain cover crops, like winter wheat, winter rye, winter triticale, do very well that way. And if we get a rain in about 2 weeks, everything will be fine. It'll do well.
So you plant
that in the September time. You harvest corn or soybeans, whichever one you had. Then the next spring in February, while the ground is kind of frozen in the morning but starting to thaw in the afternoon, during the freeze-thaw cycle, you would frost seed red clover.
Frost seed.
Is that with a airplane too?
No, you could, but that'd be expensive. I mean, you could. That would be very expensive. So you probably just on the back of a four-wheeler put some sort of broadcast seeder, you know, like the hand crank seeder that you might do in your garden.
Mm-hmm.
You would buy a larger one and put it on a four-wheeler or
a
truck.
So you just run it over the field?
You just run it over the field. You don't even really have to incorporate it because then the freeze-thaw cycle that happens in late February mm-hmm. will seed it itself. So then you have the red clover in the wheat. Then you harvest the wheat. If you're not going to leave it for a cover crop.
When do you harvest the wheat?
You harvest it in July.
Uh-huh.
Early July is when it got harvested this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then that red clover is underneath the canopy, and that's your nitrogen for your next year's corn.
Okay, so that's a year in the corn-soy rotation that you would not plant corn or soybeans.
Exactly, but you'd grow.
And how does that pencil out for somebody that's been planting corn-soy?
Yeah, so Dr. Matt Liebman at Iowa State actually has run the numbers on this, and he had oats instead of wheat in his rotation,
mm-hmm.
and he compared two-year corn and soybean economics versus three-year corn, soybeans, oats with red clover instead of wheat
mm-hmm.
versus a four-year, which is corn, soybeans, oats with alfalfa,
mm-hmm.
and then another year of alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
And so that three-year,
and the winner was?
The three-year rotation is extremely competitive. In some years, it makes more money than the two-year. It never loses money compared to the two-year. So it's very competitive, even though 1 out of 3 years you didn't grow corn and soybeans.
So you can make, as a farmer, you can make the same amount of money, improve your soil health, and reduce erosion.
Yes.
All you good farmer citizens, listen up.
And for those of us that like to eat things, remember oats, wheat, triticale, buckwheat. We like to eat that stuff, too. We just don't all eat corn and corn products.
And chickens like to eat that stuff, too.
Chickens, pigs, corn. Yes, it's all part of the system. And I think diversity is good. And plants seem to know a whole lot about growing and producing wonderful things.
On September 2nd, I think is the date, Fred Kirschman is going to come on and we're going to talk about Dan Barber's new book called The Third Plate. And a lot of it does deal with this kind of the future of food, this way of really incorporating what we're growing and how it affects the soil and how we can be supportive of those processes.
It's good to be really mindful of where our stuff comes from. So let's take a little break here and digest what we've just heard.
Thank you.
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. That's Community Radio, 89.1 FM. I want to thank you folks that have emailed in and let us know that, yes, we do have an audience out there. Thanks for your responses. Also, check out our the KHOIFM.org website. It has a Donna Lana Kitchen section on there, and now you can find some of our shows archived there. We're working on that, and there's also recipes. So check out KHOIFM.org. We're back in the studio talking about an important thing about the food cycle. We're talking about soil and cover crops and where our food comes from with Sarah Carlson.
Sarah is the Practical Farmers of Iowa Midwest Cover Crop Research Coordinator. And I had some questions that I wanted to ask Sarah. Dow Chemical has a new 2,4-D stacked traits GMO corn. Is it corn, just corn, or corn and soy? And I wanted to talk a little bit about the pesticide treadmill that perhaps we're getting on here. And is it it'll be released by next summer for sure?
Yeah, I don't know the release date. I think it is next summer. I know Dow has been doing a few field events to just sort of get people up to speed on what the technology looks like and what are the new labels that are going to be out there on the chemicals. And I guess, you know, we don't know if the new chemical, the new version of 2,4-D that will be used on these traded corn hybrids will have less drift incident. So 2,4-D
they're saying that it will.
Right. Field tests have said, research has said that it has less of a drift incident because of the crop oil or the surfactant or what's mixed with the chemical
causes it to decrease
off-site issues.
Uh-huh.
Now,
because it's a very potent herbicide as compared to glyphosate, which we are all used to by now.
Right. So it acts differently than glyphosate. That's its biggest need for really, you know, good control. So it moves
and kills a lot of other plants.
Yes.
If it's
it kills
misapplied.
Broadleaves, right?
Yes.
Right.
Oh, which would include some of these cover crops.
Yeah.
Yes. Which probably wouldn't be growing at the time that it would be sprayed,
okay.
But it would kill other things like grapes, you know, other plants that are nearby.
Milkweed.
If it volatilized and moved.
If it moved.
So the new technology supposedly is supposed to reduce that movement of it so that it only deals with the weeds, the target, where it's supposed to be applied.
And how are we going to find out if this, in fact, does that?
Yeah, so we're going to have to be vigilant. I'd say when we have drift events on our farms, on our farmsteads, on
What's
our houses.
What's a drift event?
So let's say you have plants growing out in your garden, and then you hear maybe a plane, or you hear a sprayer, or you hear a machine drive by, and then you may smell something, or you might just notice that the next day, or within like 4 days, the plants look kind of singed. And so if that's a drift event. We have a number of horticulture farmers within Practical Farmers of Iowa, and so they, you know, will send samples to the Pesticide Bureau at IDALS at the Iowa Department of Ag to get tested and record the event, and then they can see, you know, was this applicator in your area and what were they applying on that date, and is this a drift event or is this a disease, you know, so that we can really diagnose the problem.
So next year's going to be a very large experiment.
It could be, yes. But we won't have, you know, 100% turnover of, like 100% of the corn farmers aren't going to probably buy this stacked trait corn next year.
Whew.
So, you know, it'll be over like a 5 to 8 year period that we'll see, you know, maybe increased incidences, or, you know, it may be better than the 2,4-D we have now. And it may be less problemsome. And we may actually reduce our problems.
And what about this pesticide treadmill, where initially glyphosate was very effective, and now it's like kind of like antibiotic resistance, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, when you have – so, for example, in the state, close to 23 million acres being applied with the same chemical every single year.
And it's been glyphosate so far.
Yeah, for 25 years.
And next year we're going to have a new cocktail mixture.
Yeah, so the one benefit of 2,4-D is that it kills plants differently than glyphosate. So we may be attacking... So it's like if you took one antibiotic versus a different one. So sometimes when you get resistant to one, you may take a Z-Pak, and that's maybe double the strength, or it's different. Mm-hmm. And so that targets the infection differently. So that's kind of what putting 2,4-D in the mix is. I mean, we use 2,4-D now. We already use it now, and we tank mix it. We put it in a mix with glyphosate Roundup now anyways. But the difference will be we'll be able to use it later into the season than normally we would.
Which means we'll be using more of it, right?
Well, I don't know if we'll use more, but we would be using it at a different time than what we're used to.
So what people call the pesticide treadmill means that in a number of years, just like the weeds have developed a resistance to glyphosate, which is why we need a new pesticide, a new combination of pesticides, the possibility of also developing further weed resistance to 2,4-D will come up.
Well, I've kind of actually, I was looking into this scientifically because I wanted to see, you know, would a plant that was killed either this way or A versus B, could it become resistant to A and B pathways? And there's nothing in the literature that says that that's been shown. So what I'm hopeful for is that maybe the plant wouldn't become resistant to both pesticides. But
we'll see.
But who knows? Yeah. I don't have an answer to that. That would be an Iowa State Bob Hartzler question.
And also keep in mind, you're testing the plant that the pesticide is put on. We're not talking about the garden or your grapes or the stuff it drifts onto. So be careful out there, folks. It's nice to have options, but it's nice to know what's going on out
there.
Yeah,
and next summer may be a brave new world. We'll just see.
Yeah.
And Iowa's, of course, always the epicenter of all these large-scale agrochemical experiments. So
yeah,
we got our hands full here.
Yeah, but don't forget, I mean, in Ace Hardware and in your hardware store, your lawn fertilizer usually comes with 2,4-D included, so that your lawn does not have clover in it.
Yes.
Like if you want to buy fertilizer for your lawn, you have to check and see if it's Weed and Feed. That's got 2,4-D in it.
I use fish emulsion.
Yeah, so if you – there are organic options or, you know, non-chemical options for just fertilizer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those products are sold and – how homeowners are putting 2,4-D on their grass right now.
Absolutely.
So they can get rid of clover.
You have to read the labels.
Yeah.
Just like you do when you buy food. You have to read the labels.
I've never understood why people want to get rid of clover. I think it's a perfectly fine plant. It's green. It's short. It's good. That's fine. In the past Donalana Kitchen programs, we have mentioned some Practical Farmer of Iowa events. They don't just sit here and talk about things in theory. Those folks get together and have field days. Sarah, can you tell us about some fun stuff coming up?
Especially if they have to do with cover crops.
Yeah, so one just on the topic we were just talking about, we're part of a pesticide drift monitoring program. Our farmers do on-farm research to better their businesses and their farms.
And then they share it with
and
other
then they
farmers.
Share it, yes. So this Sunday, July 27th, out by the Quad Cities in Maysville, a woman who has set up a pesticide monitoring system on her farm will describe that system, and there'll be presentations about how to monitor drift. And she's a vegetable farmer, and so that's why she really wants to know how to monitor drift so that she can diagnose problems that she sees on her plants as not being disease but maybe being a drift incident. So that's this Sunday out by the Quad Cities in Maysville. And then there was a really great field day on June 5th at the Horticulture Farm here in the Ames area, the Iowa State Hort Farm. And there's another one coming up August 11th, and that's a fruit and vegetable field day. And I know there's cover crops out at that farm. So I'm thinking cover crops will also be on the agenda, and that's on August 11th. And that's in Ames at the Iowa State Horticulture Farm north of town by Gilbert.
And you can find the schedule for all of these on the Practical Farmers of Iowa website. So it's www.practicalfarmers.org, and they list all the field days there.
And I just heard of an event that we're going to sponsor, but we're not a part of, a bike ride around Story County to five different farms. And Mustard Seed Farm is one of them.
Yeah, I know. I'm supposed to be the chef on that.
So and there's five chefs
so
at
we'll
each farm.
So we'll have more information about that.
Yeah, and I don't know. Is that in September?
I don't know. I'll have to check my calendar. But we'll mention that one again when we're a little closer to the time.
And three of the five farms are Practical Farmers of Iowa members.
Uh-huh.
And they're opening up their farms for
and
this
some
tour.
Some of them have cover crops.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Well, it's good to find out what's going on out there, especially good to find out what's going on with the soil. So thank you, sir, for coming and sharing all the stuff you've learned. So stick around, and we'll see what else is coming up. Donna Lana Kitchen, KHOI Radio. During that break, we looked at each other around the table here, our engineer Rick and Sarah and Donna and I, and we decided we sure don't know a lot about soil. We're finding out new things every day.
Sarah, tell us about that experiment, about the latest discovery.
Yeah, so a woman at Iowa State University who just recently received her doctorate, she works for Dr. Kristen Hofmachl. Her name's Sarah Hargraves. She had presented a public presentation about her research and showed that, you know, certain microbes like to live by roots and certain microbes don't like to live by roots. And so when you have soil without roots, you know, maybe in between those corn rows or in between your beds.
When you're not using cover crops.
When you're not in between, right. Those soil microbes that are in between the root zones actually make nitrogen turn into the form that make it leave the soil very quickly. So they change the form of nitrogen, which makes it more likely to leave, more likely to leach out of the soil. And that's why that's one way that we know now biologically why that happens. Like, why does nitrogen leave our soils? I never knew that before.
So naked soil, no nitrogen.
Soil eventually with a rainfall would have no nitrogen. Right, because these microbes are having a party in the no root zone because they don't like the root zone. These one type of microbes. And it's just fascinating.
This is sort of like human digestion. We realize more and more we absolutely know very little about human digestion as well. We really are quite an ignorant species, and if we would just understand that and accept it.
Oh, so it's nice to have people working on this sort of thing. Something that I've been pretty ignorant about, or I'd never dealt with them before, I was blessed with a whole influx of apricots this week.
Yeah, we seem to have an unusually good year for apricots.
Yes, last year was other tree crops. Last year was a good year for apples. And now all of a sudden, apricots.
I hope this makes up for the lack of cherries and strawberries.
Oh, we shall see. We shall see. A friend invited me to come out, and I picked pails and pails and pails of apricots. They had fallen on the ground, and these are Iowa apricots. They grow here. They're small. They're small. They're not the big ones you find in the grocery store, but they're plentiful and they're sweet. I had a good time making jelly. I pitted them. Easy to pit. Just stand there with a knife and cut them half open and flick the pit out with your thumb. And then I froze a good chunk of them. But I made some apricot.
So you just
jam.
Froze them straight out. You didn't blanch them or anything.
No.
Easy.
Put them in a bag, and I throw a little bit of sugar in them to help keep the color a little bit. Mm-hmm. Shake up a little bit with the sugar and put that in the freezer. So I've got lots of stuff for smoothies. But I found a nice recipe for apricot jam with honey. This is from the book Make Confitures, The Jams and Jellies of Christine Ferber. And she comes at jams and jellies from a French perspective. So some of the things that she can get over in her country, I can't get here. For instance, her recipe for apricot jam with honey is called Apricot with Mountain Honey. Here I am in Iowa. I don't have real access to mountain honey, but we do have a lot of good Iowa bees here.
No mountains here.
No. So I'm calling mine Iowa apricot jam with prairie honey, whatever was out there. And actually, I had some buckwheat honey.
Used buckwheat honey with the apricots?
I didn't have enough for the whole recipe, but I used
a little
bit of
it. Oh, buckwheat honey has such a distinctive
flavor. It's a strong
flavor,
and that's actually in the notes of what she says about the honey. Her honey was a strong flavor. And and as I cooked the jam down, the honey flavor came out more and more. It was richer and richer, and the jam actually gets very golden, very dark, surprisingly.
This is from using honey instead of sugar.
Right. This recipe is about half and half. I mean, there's, let's see, one cup honey, 3 cups sugar for 3 pounds of apricots. So, and then you add a little water and the juice of 2 small lemons. So that's the combination of that. And the honey with the apricot was a really nice invention, and it's just really nice and tart and sweet, and I've been enjoying it. It's good.
Another thing you can do with apricots are make chutneys with apricots. For example, if you boil the apricots down with, pit them, throw them in the pot, maybe add a large diced onion, a little bit of cumin, some basil from the garden, some sugar. You could add some vinegar if you want it to be a little sweet tart, but not necessarily. And if you cook this down, this is really good on, like, a cheese plate, for example. Or I was at Story County Larker yesterday, and they had the most delicious smoked chickens. So slices of cold smoked chicken with an apricot chutney would be sublime for dinner, lunch, picnic, really good summer food.
One nice thing about apricots, at least especially these Iowa apricots, they're small. You cut them in half, and they kind of stand by themselves. They're their own little hors d'oeuvre,
little
all by
cup
themselves.
Thing.
Little cup thing all by themselves. So enjoy apricots. If you have a tree or know somebody else that has a tree, pass the word. This is the year for Iowa apricots. Also, we have the summer cool treat of the week, and here it comes, folks.
Okay, the cool treat of the week is basil ice cream. My basil is just going gangbusters right now, fortunately, and we'd have no tomatoes to put them on, so you might as well make ice cream out of it. So this is from a book, The Perfect Scoop. It says, Italian Italian basil, which has a slight anise-like scent, provides the base for this herbaceous ice cream. This is wonderful to make in the summer when large bunches of basil are abundantly available at the market. Now, they use Italian basil. I would say you could use, like, lemon basil, or Lana suggested using purple opal basil because it would make it pink. So the recipe is fairly straightforward ice cream recipe. It's 1 cup of packed basil leaves, 3/4 cup of sugar, 2 cups of heavy cream, 1 cup of whole milk, a pinch of salt, 5 large egg yolks, and 1 lemon, which they're going to only use the zest. And I will post this on the on our website at the Donna Lana Kitchen on the KHOI.
Right. That's KHOIFM.org is the website.
Right. So basically you blend the basil very thoroughly, either in a blender or a food processor, with the sugar and 1 cup of the cream until the leaves are ground as fine as possible. Then you pour half of the basil mixture into a large bowl and add the remaining 1 cup of cream. Then you do the usual thing where you warm the other half of the basil mixture with milk and salt, and then you whisk your egg yolks, and then you kind of incorporate a little of the hot mixture into the egg yolk and then put it back into the cream mixture and stir it till you get like a custard. And then you pour that mixture, the hot eggy mixture, into the rest of the basil, so you're and you strain it. So you're straining out about half of the basil. And then you zest the lemon into it and chill it and put it into the ice cream maker, whatever your favorite ice cream maker is. They also suggest pairing it with try basil ice cream paired with strawberries and lemon syrup. For 4 servings, you combine 1 cup of water and you zest the lemon into that and sort of make a sugar syrup with the zested lemon. And then you put the halved strawberries or I think peaches. I would try it with peaches into the lemon zested sugar syrup. And then it says, I like this description, to serve, spoon the strawberries or the peaches and some of the lemon syrup into shallow bowls and float a scoop of basil ice cream in the center. So that's your dessert, summer dessert of the week. So, garlic.
We have, but let's back up here. We have a question.
Oh, question.
From a listener. Thank you for calling in. It says, when weighing apricots, is the weight before or after removing the pits? Very good question. It is after removing the pits. The recipe says weight net, which means take out the icky bits. So, yes, take the pits out. Yes. Thank you for your question.
Good. Good to know somebody's thinking about these things while we're talking about it.
Right. Right.
So now Lana has the garlic report here.
Oh, here, garlic report. Late garlic harvest this year. When I guess when my garlic is ready, when it's ready to harvest, by counting how many leaves on the bottom of the garlic plant are dry. Normally, I wait for 4 leaves on the bottom of my garlic plant to dry up. Then I, of course, do a couple test pulls and see what's going underneath the ground. You don't want the garlic to mature past the point where the cloves start splitting apart the bulb. But no, it hadn't happened yet. And usually we do garlic harvest on our farm about 4th of July, but everything is screwy this year, so everything is late.
You notice that Lana harvested her garlic on probably the hottest day so far with the most mosquitoes.
You have to do that. That's part of the garlic harvest. Thanks to volunteers that came out and helped us do this. We waited for the garlic to be ready. And when you pull this garlic up, it does not look like the dried, cured stuff. It still looks like it's pretty damp, and the bulbs are very moist and doesn't have a huge paper covering yet, but those bulbs get taken up, lay in the sun for a little bit as you're gathering them up, tied together in bunches, the handy bunches, whatever's good for you, and then we hang garlic to cure, and this is if you want garlic to last through the winter. You can use garlic any time, but if you want
so
it
you
to
can
last,
eat some yeah, right after
you can pull eat it right now.
But the rest of it, you're kind of saving and curing for
it.
How long?
I a good month, and then they'll put on some good papers, good outside papers, the individual
paper, as in that wrapping that you peel off when you're doing fresh garlic clove.
And that's a good month of hanging in a nice, dry, dark barn, hanging up in those bunches. And then those garlic cloves last well through the winter. So eat garlic anytime. Right now, if you wait into those garlics, it's just wonderful and juicy and good. But
probably hot and spicy
right
now.
Oh, it is. It's pretty dandy. And yes, it was hot. It has to be hot when you harvest garlic. That's the tradition. Also, elderberries. You always have to pick elderberries for some reason when it's the most mosquito-y and hot.
But we're not there yet. They're not ready yet.
That makes the jelly taste really good when you get all
the suffering of it all.
Yeah, so that's it. So deal with the mosquitoes and deal with all the hot stuff.
And what varieties did you harvest?
Oh, the favorite garlic variety that I grow currently is called Music. It is a German hardneck. There's many varieties.
German hardneck.
I can relate to that.
A German hardneck myself.
That's it. But that's a variety, and my variety is called Music. I also save back some homegrown garlic, too. We've got some events coming up.
Yeah, on August 17th. At the end of the National Grassroots Radio Conference here in Ames, we are having a little fundraiser for KHOI at the Della Vita Wine Shop Wine Bar on Main Street. It's called Booze and Blues. And I just found out that Scott Coldiron, who was with us last week, is going to bring his wood-fired pizza oven there, and he will be handing out pizza samples. So come on by. We'll have a nice silent auction to benefit the radio station. So that will be a Sunday evening, August 17th. I believe it's 6 to 9 or something like that. But we'll be announcing that again.
Yes. So support your local radio station. Come to the silent auction. Look into the National Grassroots Radio Conference. You can find that by going to KHOI Community Radio, KHOIFM.org, and find out more about that. Support your local radio station. It only happens because there's volunteers doing this sort of thing. We thank everybody who helps make this happen. Thanks to our special guests today. You've been listening to The Donna Lana Kitchen with special guest Sarah Carlson from the Practical Farmers of Iowa talking about soil and cover crops. You've been listening to Music by the Barn Owl Band. This last cut is called The Cloud Forest, and we'll go out with that. Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen every Tuesday at noon. It's repeated 7 p.m. on KHOI Radio, so Tuesday at noon, 7 o'clock at night. Thanks for your input as listeners. Thanks for calling in and asking questions. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food, enjoy life.